Call a meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order, and we have a pretty busy agenda today. We'd like to begin as close to on time as possible. Three items on the agenda today. Four?
Four, I see.
Is that correct? There are four. I begin by offering, well, let's do the minutes right off the bat. Minutes, okay. We didn't rehearse this very well. I'll begin by moving House File 4039, and
how are we going to do this?
Judy Borgen?
Welcome, Chair Norton. I took my chair over. Judy Borgen from Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I'm here today to speak to House File 4039. Basically, the bill is our technical bill. It does, in Section 1, clarifies that the administrative fee that's paid by senior citizens is to recover the administrative costs, not the total cost of the program. Section 2 states that the closed enrollment contract training is the program that is not available for the senior citizen tuition discount or tuition break. Section 3 of the bill removes obsolete language related to a 1997 study of negative time reporting that has been completed. Section 4 of the bill, Sections 4 and 5 of the bill, basically codify what is the current practice that has been agreed to and is currently in place since the merger of the two systems. This language that you see was developed in conjunction with the Department of Finance and has been approved. That concludes my presentation. Is there any questions?
I think that's the record. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Members have questions? I should have included in my original motion, and I'll renew my motion, that House File 4039 pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you very much. Okay, next item on our agenda is supplemental budget request from Hinskew. Welcome back.
See if I can break my record on this one, too.
There are handouts that the members will find in their packets.
Judy Borgen from Minnesota State College and University. Rather than actually having a PowerPoint, I just thought we'd kind of quickly go through the supplemental budget request from the system. This was submitted to the governor, was, however, not included in his supplemental budget request. We are requesting four items, a total of $31.5 million. The first of those is a request for technology. We have a request for energy, $10 million. We have a global skills initiative request of $3.5 million and a request of $3 million for a consortium for excellence in biosciences. Our technology request is $15 million in one-time money. This is basically to upgrade our current IT system, which is now at least in part over 10 years old and does need some improvement. We want to be sure that it meets the current demand. Certainly students are taking a lot of their classes online, but also most of them or many of them are doing their registration, paying their tuition and all those kind of things, getting their grades and everything else online. So there's definitely a strain on the infrastructure, both of our network, our hardware and software. So we're asking for money to help us begin what is the four-year strategic plan that is before our board now for consideration to do a major influx of dollars into our IT system to bring it up so that we can meet the demands of the students, also to be sure that it is secured. Our second request is $10 million. This is an ongoing request for $10 million for energy to pay for the increased cost of our fuel and utilities. We see now that we have had a warmer winter, and so this year perhaps we've had some savings, or at least not as much of an increase as we anticipated. We still are over what we had, what we planned in terms of our budget for fuel for this year, but it certainly wasn't as bad. But as we look to next year, we can't count on having another warm winter or a very cool summer, so we're looking at meeting this. We find that as we look at our fuel costs, we have found they very seldom go down. There's always seems to be, at least in particular electricity and natural gas, a steady increase in those costs, and they never return to what they were the previous year. So we feel that this is a base dollars that we would like. The third item we have is a $3.5 million request for a global skills initiative. Many of the members of our system were part of the governor's trade mission to China. This sort of came out of that. It is money that would begin to allow us to build capacity for Chinese language instruction, also providing some history courses and culture courses of Chinese, and maybe in the Indian and India and Turkey as well. It allows us to begin to position ourselves to be able to provide customized training to that Chinese market to meet the demands in such things as aviation maintenance or management and repair, automotive technology, certainly home health care and manufacturing are areas where it was identified that we could certainly serve it with some of our technical programs. Would also allows us to develop and create some more exchange programs for both our students and faculty. And our final request is $3 million, again in base dollars, to extend to kind of form a consortium for our biosciences. This is an area where there's a recognized need in different industry sectors, medical devices, biotechnology, renewable energy, and nanotechnology. And we think that there are some things there that we can do to meet that if we can do it in a coordinated function. This would help us also to establish an office that would kind of be the try to maximize the efficiencies of this money by providing some common functions, some of the administrative kinds of functions like management or like marketing and managing grant applications and things like that. With that, it concludes my presentation. Basically, I have the four items, a total of $31.5 million. And I stand for questions.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, of the $15 million in technology, how much of that goes to Minsky Central, and how much of that would go to the campuses?
Borgen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I don't have that on the top of my head. I would guess that the majority of this is the infrastructure expenditures. Most of that is system expenditures on behalf. I mean, really, it supports the campuses. It's money that provides the line services and upgrades the network at the campuses. But it probably would be spent centrally as we have better purchasing power as a central entity rather than an individual.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be most interested in having to know exactly where the money would go.
I certainly
and then
see
the
that.
Complement, if there is new complement, that would be needed. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, my next question goes to the Global Skills Initiative. $3.5 million. Does Minsky need more complement at Minsky Central to do this? And if so, how many more complement would be needed at Minsky Central under this $3.5
million?
Ms. Borgen. Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I believe that this is all money that would be spent at the campus.
Then, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, I'd like to see that number,
okay,
too.
All right.
And by campuses, I mean real campuses, not the campus in downtown St. Paul. All right? And then the last one, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, this Consortium for Excellence. Ms. Borgen, I thought we had targeted money in the last higher education bill for centers of excellence. What's the difference in this Consortium of Excellence as opposed to the Centers of Excellence?
Ms. Borgen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, this is as we did receive $10 million for Centers of Excellence, and we have awarded those to four of our institutions. We had an application in that round for a center in biosciences. We did not have sufficient money to go that far. That was probably of the centers, of the four centers that we, or of the five centers that we had proposals for, that was the one that was the, needed the most additional work, I guess, to bring up to being competitive with the ones that were funded. So this is an opportunity for us to put money in that to bring up the biosciences so that they can really, in fact, become a center of excellence at some point.
Mr. Chair, this is going to be very repetitive today then, too. I would like to know the complement at Minsky Central that would be needed to support this.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, can you tell me the target number for this division?
Yes, I can.
Mr. Chair, would you?
Oh, really? You really want to hear it?
I think I know, but, you know, it's one of those questions you ask and to find out.
Yes. And they're setting those numbers, I think, as we sit here.
Right by my office downstairs, I mean.
But the number that we have at last report was $4.8
million. $4.8 for everything. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, a 4.8, not 31.5, what do you really need?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we did not put these in priority order.
You also don't have to answer if you don't
want to. And I guess at this point, I would not want to put one of them above the other.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
I do shouldn't have to answer, but let's see. My question to you earlier this week was when we would have the higher education finance bill. I believe you said the 11th. That's not that far away. Now we have their supplemental request in front of us, and we have a target number. And one of the things that is annoying about individuals or systems when they come up is this sort of cavalier way that they say, well, we didn't prioritize. And when you don't, we will. You can bet we will. So if you don't give us any ranking, we'll rank it for you. And that's why my other questions were, where is this money going to go? Is it going to go campus-based? Is it more complement at Minsky Central? At Minsky Central, Representative Dorn and I got a very nice tour of the chancellor, and we were walking up one morning in our, what we like to call homeless clothing, in our annual morning jaunt. And, you know, there's about 300 people there. So I'm really interested if we need more than 300 people to do what you're doing here as opposed to the campuses that did get cuts in 03. So, I would like some answer. There must be something that's more important than something else here. I know you're not the chancellor or the vice chancellor, but you are doing the presentation. So there must be a reason for you being
here. Ms. Borgen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, my personal opinion, I would say that we would like the money for technology.
Okay, thank you.
That helps.
Is there anyone else that needed to help? Okay, no further. On my list, I have Hal Kimball as somebody that would like to address the committee. Welcome back. You were here Monday, right?
Yes, sir.
Please identify yourself. We've maybe forgotten your name already, so. For the record.
My name is Hal Kimball. I am a student at St. Cloud State University and the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. And I'm here today to testify on our association's stance on the Minsky Supplemental Budget. Chair Norris, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I want to thank you for your past support in your past support of higher education in the state of Minnesota. The students of state universities support a supplemental budget request that differs from that of our system. We support appropriation, first and foremost, $16.5 million for a tuition buy-down, and then secondly, $15 million for the technology needs of our system. Our students have met on several occasions this year to discuss the possibility of a supplemental budget request. Utmost in our minds is ensuring that public higher education in the state of Minnesota remains affordable, accessible, and of high quality. The Department of Finance has stated that supplemental budget requests should be, quote, focusing on necessary fixes to the recently passed budget or addressing emergency situations that have arisen since the legislative session, unquote. We also know that to our students across this state, there is no greater emergency in higher education than the need to once again find another way to pay hundreds of more dollars for their education than they did the year before. As I have stated previously in many testimony, in many times, my generation is burdened by debt. Young couples graduate from public institutions today with almost the equivalent of a mortgage. A whole generation of our youth is now unable to accept jobs in the public service sector because of the amount of debt that we hold. For the state universities, our tuition is expected to rise by 8.4%, or $404 per student. And the question that I have asked many people is, where are we going to find this money? For our average work-study student, they will have to work an additional 50 hours next year. In March 2005, Student Financing Survey, published by MinSCU, indicates that 75% of our students do not receive any sort of financial aid from their families. This survey also said that 17% of our students, or about 31,000, say they have had to stop taking classes or have had to work more hours at some point or take an extra job to pay for their college costs. Our first priority is tuition relief. A supplemental budget, in our opinion, should be used to help lower tuition. If the legislature were to appropriate $16.5 million for tuition relief, it could lower tuition on our campuses by 3%. As we all know, there are expenses that must be met, such as fuel costs and technology needs that need to be addressed. However, we know that we don't have any guarantees that you will fund this. But we do know that these budgets already account for the fuel costs. As a result, the proposed tuition increases are higher than would be necessary if additional state funding is obtained. We feel that if funding for these additional expenses is provided by the legislature this session, that tuition costs should reflect that. Now, in working with the system on the supplemental budget request, we have reached an understanding with our Board of Trustees, the Office of the Chancellor, and many of our administrations. If the system is funded, the system has pledged to revisit tuition costs, the budget situation with the students. Our students feel very strongly that if any monies for the system request or for fuel are appropriated, that these monies should return to the students in tuition relief. Now, I understand, having heard just earlier about $4.8 million as kind of being the target, that would buy down almost 1% of tuition. I do thank you for your time and your consideration, and I will yield for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. Any questions from members? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on our agenda is House File 3975. Representative Rudolph. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Rudolph?
Yes, I move the bill 3975.
Pass and possible
for it to pass, possible inclusion. Likely inclusion, I would say.
The in the interest of time,
we're ready to go.
Do it.
Here we go. I'd like to wear my glasses, I guess. I'd like to outline two important requests in this supplemental budget from the University of Minnesota. One from the College of Veterinary Medicine for their Veterinary Medical Center, and one from the School of Dentistry for their simulation clinic. Both requests are for one-time funds for equipment. The Veterinary Medicine requests $3.2 million for an MRI system, $1.3 million for a linear accelerator, and $0.9 million for radiology equipment. I would raise the concern that nearly 75% of new emerging infectious diseases originate in animals. We currently face the possible introduction of avian flu into the United States, and Minnesota is number one in America in turkey production. And the U of M could play a critical role in addressing this potential crisis, but needs updated equipment to do the job. The School of Dentistry requests $4.9 million in funds for simulation workstations and advanced simulation units. If the university is to attract faculty and to get students into their program, this is vital. With me are Dr. Jeffrey Klossner and Dr. Patrick Lloyd from the University of Minnesota to further explain the requests that they have. And before I turn to I think we'll go with Dr. Klossner first. They commented, it's rare you have three deans in a row up here, but we do today.
Please identify yourself for the tape, please.
My name is Dr. Jeff Klossner. I'm the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Chair Nordis and committee members, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about veterinary medicine as part of the University of Minnesota's supplemental request. As you know, the mission of the College of Veterinary Medicine is to improve the animal health of animals in Minnesota. We also work to improve human health by keeping our food supply safe and preventing us from many infectious diseases. And we also have a significant role that we play in the economic health of Minnesota by supporting the $10 billion food animal industry. Never in recent memory has a strong College of Veterinary Medicine been more important to Minnesota. As Representative Rudolph noted, Asian H5N1 influenza will probably enter the United States this spring through bird migrations, putting Minnesota's $800 million turkey industry at risk. Bovine tuberculosis has recently reemerged in cattle and wild deer in northwestern Minnesota after a 30-year absence. Chronic wasting disease, a disorder that's similar to mad cow disease, has been identified in farm deer and elk in Minnesota. Attracting and retaining outstanding faculty is key if the College of Veterinary Medicine is to be successful in dealing with these threats. Just some of the things that faculty have worked on recently that have made a huge impact in Minnesota include faculty have developed diagnostic tests and a vaccine for avian pneumovirus, a disease that was costing Minnesota turkey producers more than $15 million a year. Faculty have developed a rapid diagnostic test for detecting the porcine reproductive and respiratory disease virus in boar semen, thus helping prevent the spread of this economically important disease in Minnesota. And faculty have developed a novel bacterial culture system for milk that's helping to reduce the prevalence of mastitis in Minnesota dairy cattle. The competition for faculty is fierce in this country. Retaining faculty has become more and more of a problem. Securing and retaining the best of the best from Minnesota truly is a competitive advantage for this state. And having state-of-the-art equipment is key to our ability to retain faculty and to recruit faculty to Minnesota. I want to tell you a little story about gliomas, which are a brain tumor in people, and that will explain, I think, why these two pieces of equipment are so critical. Glioma is a malignant tumor that affects humans. It's the most common malignant tumor of the brain. Unfortunately, it is now and has been for a long time 100% fatal. The survival times are less than 6 months, and there's been no significant advancement in the treatment of glioma in the past 25 years. Neuroscientists in the medical school at the University of Minnesota have recently developed a novel therapy in which they inject genes, have injected genes into animals that have experimentally induced gliomas, and have found that following the injection of those genes, radiation therapy was very successful in reducing the size of those gliomas. It's probably the most exciting advance that's been made in recent years in that disease. So how does the College of Veterinary Medicine fit in? Well, dogs also get gliomas. And unlike the disease that was induced in mice, dogs develop gliomas spontaneously. So they would like to collaborate with faculty at the College of Veterinary Medicine in a study to see if this novel gene therapy would be as successful as it was in mice in dogs. And if it's successful in dogs, it's very likely to be successful in people. In order for us to collaborate in that study, we need state-of-the-art radiation equipment, a linear accelerator. Our present therapy, radiation therapy equipment, is more than 25 years old. In order for us to collaborate in this study, we need to be able to look inside the body, and that's the MRI machine. We need to be able to evaluate decreases in size of these tumors. In order to do these kinds of studies and to attract faculty, again, we need this equipment in our veterinary college. We have been working for 4 years to attract a comparative oncologist. That's an oncologist who studies both animal and human disease so that you can use animals as models so that you can improve the animal health and improve human health. And again, one of the reasons that we've been unsuccessful is because of the lack of these two pieces of equipment, a linear accelerator and an MRI, a magnetic resonance machine. In addition, finally, the $900,000 for additional radiographic equipment, what we want to do is to be able to help veterinarians in outstate Minnesota with their disease problems. We want them to be able to send us radiographs through telemetry so that we can help them better provide animal health in outstate Minnesota. And that's the last piece of equipment. So I thank you very much for allowing us to present the supplemental request to you. And I'm here to answer any questions about the College of Veterinary Medicine's part of the University of Minnesota supplemental request.
Thank you very much. See any questions at this time? I should point out that some of our members are at a Ways and Means Committee right now, so it's not a lack of interest. We just have two places to be, and that's where they chose to be.
There's a tape they can watch us later.
Right? That's right. That's right. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. I'm Patrick Lloyd, Dean of the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota. Chairman Nordis and committee members, I'm here to appeal to your support for our request for additional dollars, supplemental dollars, to allow the university's dental school to attract some new equipment that allows our students to be able to be competitive, allow them to advance through their curriculum training, and to support initiatives on our campus. The request that we're making is really, truly a partnership between the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, and our partners in the community. We're requesting $4.9 million for what is a $10.5 million initiative. This is the first appreciable type of remodeling or renovation the school has experienced since it was constructed in 1974. We're the only dental school between Milwaukee and Seattle. We have a tremendous amount of geographic responsibility to attend to the needs of the residents of the state and surrounding states who support us through non-resident tuition. Because of that, we're looking always for attracting the greatest number or highest number of quality students and faculty. These request dollars allow us to partner with our corporate sponsors. We've to date received $1 million from 3M to support the project. We've raised nearly $1 million from our private sources. And the president of the university has stepped forward with a $3 million support for the project. As I travel around the state and visit with alumni throughout the country, they ask me when I discuss this particular project, is the state supportive? What kind of assistance is the state providing this particular initiative? And they use that as a gauge as to how generous that they will be in supporting this particular initiative. I'm here today to ask your request for this support to allow us to continue to attract the best quality students, the kind of faculty that we need. Part of this project is tied up with our interest in allowing students to gain their hand-eye fine motor coordination skills earlier in their curriculum so that they can enter the clinic situation earlier and adapt to patient treatment protocols earlier in their programs. Mm-hmm. This will allow them to engage in outside activities through our outreach efforts around the state in the Twin Cities area so that they're exposed to a variety of career opportunities upon graduation. We give greater consideration to locating in parts of the state where we have a greater need for providers. We train approximately 80% of the dentists in the state and about 60% of the specialists. This particular technology will allow us to enhance the retention rate of our graduates so the greater number of students who complete their dental education at the University of Minnesota look at Minnesota as a home where they'll practice and spend their 30-plus years of practice. This afternoon with me to provide additional testimony are some of our students, as well as representatives from the Minnesota Dental Association, who've gotten on board for their support with this particular project. So I look forward to getting your support, and I'd be happy to entertain questions you may have about the particulars of our request.
Members have questions? You mentioned students. Do they just want to be recognized, or do they have
something? Well, I have three, and I have two in particular that might have a chance to share with you their own thoughts on this particular request.
Okay. Again, we can keep the testimony as brief as possible, so we I think we have an amendment here we have to deal with. And
with me this afternoon is Mitch Eggleston, who is a resident of Stillwater, Amy Gihant, who is from Colorado, as well as two other students, Marty Spanish and Matt Swanson. They are all third-year dental students, and they have had a chance to participate with the technology that we use now and can comment specifically about things that they've seen at other schools in the Big Ten and the Upper Midwest. We also have a representative, Pat Glassroot, from the Minnesota Dental Association, to comment about the support of state's dentists.
All right. Maybe they could all come up here at one time. Representative Erdl might have to give up his seat temporarily.
Yeah, I'm willing to do that. Where am I?
Again, we welcome you to the committee. We do have a bit of a time crunch,
yeah.
So if you can keep it as brief as possible.
Yeah.
Identifying yourself?
My name is Amy Gihant, and I'm from Colorado, as Dean Lloyd said, and we just wanted to, make you guys aware that we as students are in support of this, and that it's important that, the students graduating the University of Minnesota are as competent as those dentists in other states. The Sim Clinic would draw competitive students and prepare, the dentists here for the people we serve. Being from Colorado, as far as, what's going to keep me in this state, I think it's important that, for continuing education to have a clinic like this where we can grow our skills and not just remain stagnant in that. So I think this proposal is a much-needed change that necessary.
Thank you for choosing Minnesota.
Yeah.
Please identify yourself.
Mitch Ellinson. I'm from Stillwater, Minnesota. I also would like to speak in support of the supplemental budget request. I have been to a number of schools that have all either planning on to implement these SIM clinics or have them already, and it is very beneficial for us to not only get consistent information from our professors, but also increase our hand speed, which is a very large portion of what we need to learn before we can graduate, and these SIM clinics greatly accelerate that. And due to these other schools having those types of SIM clinics, they've kind of set a new national standard where you get to a certain point in your education before you graduate, and this would help University of Minnesota to follow those schools and become a leader of the national standards once again.
Thank you very much. You want to move the microphone to the other end of the by yourself for the record, please.
I am Marty Spanish. I'm a third-year dental student. Mitch and Amy are talking about technology, and I agree with that. I think technology is one of the most important factors in achieving, better education, better dentists through the school of dentistry. My dad is a dental salesman for Henry Schein, and he just had a meeting about, through the dental association, and he was telling me all this stuff about new technology and new ergonomic ways and new education that he's getting, and I feel we should as dental students be receiving the same education as he is. So that's why I'm pushed for the future of technology for the dental students in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Matt Swanson. I'm a third-year dental student, and I grew up in Orem, Minnesota. If I can make an analogy, albeit possibly a poor one, I would say our current clinic is like using a typewriter in the age of the Internet and email. Although it is reliable and does get the job done, it has come to a point where it's not practical anymore. And this new money would help fund technology that will keep us current and be one of the best schools in the Big Ten.
Just ask a question. Do you know what a manual typewriter is?
Yeah. Unfortunately, no.
I'm at the Science Museum, I think.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
One more.
Do we have another?
Okay.
Oops, two more.
Okay.
Anyone else?
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dominic Scuzzetto. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Dental Association to also lend our support to this proposal. As you've heard, the clinic and the equipment is well over 30 years old in many cases and in need of updating to the technology that we have now. We're very concerned about giving students a chance to get out into the community to practice, to begin to practice, to feel comfortable in that setting. We have probably a great majority of dentists, especially in greater Minnesota, that may be retiring in the next 10 to 15 years. We want to make sure that we have people there to come back and provide dental care to your communities, and this would be a step in that direction. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Pat Glassroot. I'm Director of Policy Development for the Minnesota Dental Association. And I have also, though, been an adjunct associate professor at the School of Dentistry for a number of years, not quite as long as when I remember the building being built, but I do remember when it was constructed over 30 years ago. It is time to update the equipment. And as policy development director, I know that if our students are able to go through their clinical instruction sooner and get out into the community sooner, it's definitely going to have an impact, a positive impact on dental access throughout Minnesota. So it's a win-win for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl?
Looking for more.
that's
okay.
Yeah. They did a great job. I should just point out, you weren't here 10 years ago, the first year I was here. I worked 2 weeks in the legislature with an abscess tooth. So this is very dear to my heart.
Conflict of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just speaking with Senator Dill. I thought maybe we're back in the teeth floating discussion from last year. That was an ag joke, hidden with horses.
I thought you were talking about false teeth. Okay.
All right.
Move on. An amendment, would you like to
do? Yes, I think we'll do the amendment unless there is anyone else at this time. I don't think there are.
I think we're ready for the amendment.
All right, let's do the amendment, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman.
It certainly is.
Okay, I'll...
A1?
You have the A1 amendment. We'll move that.
Do you want to discuss it?
Yeah.
We'll vote on it?
No. I offer this amendment because of concerns brought to me by apple growers and members of agricultural groups relating to the University of Minnesota's new process of granting exclusive licensing rights for a variety of apples to one private grower. There is considerable consternation and questions about the effects that this procedure will have upon the apple industry in Minnesota and the ultimate impact on other segments of our agriculture economy. Since for whatever reasons these groups have been unable to come together and reach an agreement, I propose a task force to work with the concerned groups to address their concerns. And those who have contacted me in support of this, the Minnesota Farm Bureau, the Minnesota Farmers Union, the Minnesota Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association, Minnesota Soybean Association, Minnesota Wheat Growers Association, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Do you have anyone that would like to
yes.
testify before we vote on the amendment?
Yes. Mr. Brickholz,
Mr. Townsend.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Burkholz, and I own Pleasant Valley Orchard in Schaefer, Minnesota, which is in between the large towns of Center City and Taylor's Falls in Chisago City, north of the Twin Cities. I am currently vice president of the Minnesota Apple Growers Association. The purpose of the association, which has been in existence since 1933, is to promote and encourage the orderly and efficient production, distribution, and sale of Minnesota apples and apple products for the mutual benefits of its members and to represent the interests interests of Minnesota apple growers in any matter pertaining to the welfare of the apple growing industry in Minnesota. We have about 120 members that can cover most of the commercial growers in the state of Minnesota. Without getting into the details of all the details of the license agreement, let me just cover a list of some of the issues. Minnesota Apple Growers Association supports legislation to establish this task force that Representative Rudolph has in the amendment to help the apple industry and the University of Minnesota develop ways to release new plant varieties to the market in a way that treats all Minnesota businesses fairly. Our association notified a full range of university officials in early December of 2005 of our concerns with the radical new license agreement for the MN-1914 apple selection. The first time we were officially notified by the university was in November of 2005. So we responded a short time after that in writing to the university. The university to date has been dismissive of our concerns. That's why we're here today. The apple growers do support funding for the University of Minnesota Apple Breeding Program. Minnesota legislative appropriations directly fund a substantial portion of the program. Past appropriations also capitalized the patented varieties that bring royalty revenue to the university. While the university should be fairly compensated for its apple variety inventions, their compensation model should do no harm to home state growers. The apple breeding program at the university has to date served Minnesotans well. About 80% of the apples grown in Minnesota orchards are from varieties developed at the University of Minnesota. Our unique regional industry depends on full access to university varieties, including the new premium ones, to remain viable. The decision to exclusively license the 1914 apple selection was made in a partial vacuum. The University of Minnesota did not inform or seek input from the Minnesota apple industry through its Minnesota Apple Growers Association for any of its decisions regarding the license. When we first heard about it from the university, it was basically informed, we were informed it was a done deal, and they were going to follow through with this, and they were just informing us. Because of this, they overlooked important details that would have ensured funding for the university, but not damaged existing Minnesota growers. While the majority of Minnesota growers direct retail their fruit, 75% of the Minnesota apple crop is grown for wholesale distribution, and many of those who retail fruit also wholesale as a substantial part of their business. Allowing retail distribution by an orchard but not wholesale cuts the legs out from under many businesses. While licensing plant materials is becoming more common, this is a radically different license. No apple variety in this country funded by the public has ever been exclusively licensed to a single private entity. In all cases, managed apple varieties and other fruit are made generally available to growers in the home state or country of origin and exclusively licensed outside of the state or country. This recognizes their responsibilities to home state taxpayers and citizens. You will hear of the apple variety Pink Lady, which you can find in the grocery stores, as an example of a managed variety. That variety was developed in Australia and actually can be grown by anybody in this country included as a Cripps Pink. You buy it, it's called Cripps Pink. The Pink Lady concept is a trademarked marketing process. If you meet certain standards that the company that owns the trademark accepts, you can take a Cripps Pink apple that anybody can grow and you can sell it with the Pink Lady name and the Melting Heart logo that they use and sell that. That is way different from what's being proposed in this current licensing agreement for the 1914 apple. This license creates unfair markets. Giving exclusive wholesale distribution rights to one Minnesota business for an early season premium apple variety that by the university's own admission comes along only once in a generation will ensure market dominance by the licensee. Free markets, not the University Board of Regents, should determine the success or failure of apple growers in the state. Bottom line is, we feel for plant materials developed at the University of Minnesota under public funding, all apple growers should be able to grow and distribute their apples. Outside of the state is a different story, and that apples could be managed there. We look forward to the opportunity to serve our customers the best in Minnesota-grown apples and will participate positively in this process. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody have a question? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burkholz, interesting to hear all this information. I'm not very familiar with how apples that are developed are handled in other states, although I thought I heard you say that this agreement, with this 1914 apple, other states doing these kinds of agreements or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, the answer is no. There are no releases of apple varieties from a publicly funded program that are handled in this way.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up?
Representative Cox.
Generally, when the universities develop apples like this, are they, did I hear you say they're patented and copyrighted and trademarked and all that of the apple variety?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, yes, the University of Minnesota began, I believe, in about 1990 to patent its apple varieties. Honeycrisp was, to my knowledge, the first patented variety that's patented, and growers pay a royalty fee of $1 per tree that goes to the University of Minnesota at the time they purchase an apple tree for planting in their orchard.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, we'll move on. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carl Townsend. My wife and I own and operate a small family apple orchard in this village of Dassel, Minnesota, located about 50 miles west of the Twin City. I'm going to speak today on the effects of just my particular operation. The state is about 75% wholesale, 25% retail, if you look at the market for apples. Our particular operation, we sell half of our apples at wholesale and half our apples at a roadside market. Our wholesale operation is the term is used store door. We sell to the individual grocery stores. The produce managers that I deal with insist that I carry the full line of Minnesota apples, so they have one person to deal with for their needs throughout the fall season. If I don't have a major exciting new variety like this, produce manager will be forced to go to someone that can sell him everything. This is not just a hypothetical. Last year we had a short crop on Honeycrisp. I ran out and every single produce manager went to another business. You have to have all the apples they need. They don't have time to go to Joe for one variety and Pete for another one. The second issue I'd like to talk about is that of the increased costs that I'd be seeing here. The royalty fees over the life of this apple would be about $45 a tree. That's $3 per tree per year plus the dollar up front, as opposed to today being about $1 a tree. I also would be limited to only planting 1,000 trees maximum. This is about an acre and two-thirds of apples with the planting system that we use of 600 trees an acre. To give you a comparison, I have 22-acre orchard, which is considered small. I have 5 acres of Honeycrisp, 3 acres of an exciting new variety called Zestar, and I would not be able to supply even my retail needs, especially in years of crop shortage. The apples industry, you don't get the same amount of apples every year. It's quite cyclical. Get a big crop one year, small crop the next. You have to be prepared for that. That also affects us in the year that we would have a bounty, actually too many apples for our site. I would not be able to wholesale those anywhere else. I'd be forced to dump a very expensive apple. That's all.
Okay.
How much do these cost you a year?
In terms of cost per year, the tree cost per year is about $3 a year. One interesting fact I took a look at the other day, the amount of taxes that I'm paying on my Schedule F, in other words, the net farm income, I divided that by the number of trees that I have on my property. And it comes to about $4 per tree per year that I'm making at my business. I believe that's a fairly typical number. The fees here are $3 a tree a year. So, just about wipes you out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just had a question, a curiosity question. Are you mechanized, or is it a lot of manual labor as far as harvesting your crop goes?
Harvesting is done with my left hand and my right hand.
I didn't know if there was some magic thing that went up and got them for you or not.
Not if you'd like fresh apples.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the information that was handed out to us, talking about this new variety of orchard and the agreement in place, it says if you're wanting to grow it, you'd have to commit to a production of 10,000 bushels. Is that a lot of bushels for an apple orchard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, this would not apply to family size operations at all. Okay. My total production is approximately 5,000 boxes a year for all of my varieties. There's absolutely no way that I can partake in that. In addition, that would only be for sale direct to the holder of a license.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bruno, I need to ask if there are others in the...
Mr. Chairman, I'm guessing the University of Minnesota would like to respond.
We invite them up at this time. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Deb Durgan. I'm the director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to just talk a little bit about the University of Minnesota's commitment to the apple industry and also our commitment to releasing not only apple varieties but other varieties through the Agricultural Experiment Station. As was just mentioned here, the University of Minnesota has a long history in releasing apples and supporting the apple industry. There was much conversation about one of our apples, Honeycrisp, which is a premium apple that is sold not only in Minnesota but throughout the U.S. Also, another promising variety that was mentioned was Zestar. Zestar, again, one of the apples that was released from the Minnesota University of Minnesota breeding program. Our apple breeders have worked hand-in-hand with the Minnesota apple industry to really look at the type of varieties that are grown here in Minnesota and the type of varieties that Minnesota growers can produce. We've had conversations about how to release varieties. We have a committee at the University of Minnesota called the Horticultural Variety Release Committee, and we have a committee on agronomic crops that look at each of our variety releases, be they agronomic crops or horticultural crops, to determine whether, first of all, whether that variety should be released. Is it new to the marketplace? Is it has some value to the marketplace? Is it different from what's out there? And then we also have conversations about how that particular variety should be released. Should it be released publicly or should it be released privately through license? This has been a long conversation that we've had with many of our commodity groups and growers. And if we look at agronomic crops, they really are the ones that are leading the way in looking at licenses versus public releases. We have for many years have had various exclusive licenses with soybean varieties that have been released in the state. We've worked hand in hand with our soybean growers to accomplish this. But we have also released soybean varieties publicly so that they're available without license, so some royalty. And we will continue to do this. As was mentioned, University of Minnesota has a proud history of releasing apple varieties, but we are only one of two public apple breeding programs in the U.S. One of the reasons for this is the time and money commitment that it takes to release an apple variety. If we look at Honeycrisp, that original crop for that particular apple happened 30 years ago. So it takes up to 30 years to really take a look at this apple, evaluate this apple, and then release it to the marketplace. That is a large commitment in both time and resources. And as you know, the original breeder, as you can imagine, that made this first cross was not the breeder that released this apple because of a long time commitment. So because of that, and as was mentioned, the resources that the University of Minnesota has for agricultural research has been decreasing. It is a fact and something that we need to respond to. We feel that by providing some of our technology, our varieties, through licenses, are a way to support that breeding program and for that money to go back into the breeding programs and to support the program. We believe that licensing this new variety is not only good for the University of Minnesota and our apple breeding program, but it can serve the apple industry. We also understand that this is a new way of doing business, and the question was, is this done with other public apple breeding programs? The answer to that is no, because there really is only one other one in the U.S. that is publicly funded. So is this new? Yes. Will this hurt Minnesota apple growers? We believe that this will help and ensure that this particular apple variety will be available for apple growers for a long time to come. As was mentioned, apple growing is a big investment for the growers. Growing the trees, maintaining the trees is a long-term commitment. We are concerned now with some issues that we feel that this license can address that are now happening to Honeycrisp. Honeycrisp is grown widely, not only in the U.S., but in several other countries. There is a large supply of Honeycrisp throughout the U.S. and also here in Minnesota. We're concerned about the quality of that Honeycrisp apple. Many people are saying that the Honeycrisp that they are getting now are not the Honeycrisp that they got a while ago. Part of that is all about quality control and maintaining a premium apple. Our Minnesota growers have profited from Honeycrisp in that it's a premium apple and it can demand a premium price. We feel that some of the varieties that are released from the University of Minnesota will benefit from licensing so that we can maintain the market for those varieties, can maintain the quality of those varieties, and will well serve the industry. So again, the University of Minnesota is not opposed to a task force. We feel that a task force as proposed by the representative will help with conversations, and we can have conversations about how we do license varieties and release varieties. However, we do feel that licensing is in the benefit of not only the growers of the state, but the University of Minnesota and the taxpayers of the state, in that we are trying to, again, continue to support our plant breeding programs. So with that, I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no questions, at least at this time, Mike, we welcome you to our committee also. State your name for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Tony Strauss. I'm Assistant Vice President for Technology Transfer at the University of Minnesota. So I head the office that's responsible for the licensing program at the university and did the license agreement for this particular apple. I'll try to keep my comments really brief. There's just a couple of things I'd like to do to try to put this in a little bit of context, and I think it's already been set up here fairly well. This is a new way of doing things. This is something that, from our standpoint, or at least with apples, evolved from our experience with Honeycrisp and the issues that we encountered in that licensing program. So when Minnesota 1914 came along as a new potential premium variety and something that maybe only happens once or twice in a generation of an apple breeding program, we felt that it warranted close scrutiny as to how to best get it out in the marketplace, how to best realize the potential of that apple to be out in the marketplace and be recognized as a premium variety. And we spent a lot of time thinking about how to best do that. And the best way that we came up with is to do this through an exclusive licensing arrangement. And the principal motivation for that was really to maintain the control over the quality in the marketplace, to control the brand and to make it something that would be recognized as a quality brand and carry through on that potential. As has been pointed out, this is something that is new to us in an apple variety. It is, to the best of our knowledge, not something that another publicly funded apple has been marketed this way, but there are other premium apples that were not publicly funded that are marketed in an exclusive kind of way. But it's not surprising that that there aren't other publicly funded apples out there, because there's only one other program that is really equivalent to the University of Minnesota. And this is a new way of approaching getting this done. It is, though, consistent with trends in other horticultural varieties, including those funded at public universities. It is consistent with crop varieties and other means, or other kinds of agronomic products going out from research universities. It is a reality of the marketplace, and we felt we needed to respond to that reality of the marketplace. A couple of things I'd like to point out with respect to the agreement that I think have been maybe not stated in the clearest way possible. The $3 per tree royalty for Minnesota growers is the maximum that our licensee can charge. It's not clear to me what, in fact, our licensee will charge. They can, of course, charge up to that $3 maximum, but we put a limit on it, and it's not certainly a requirement on a licensee to charge $3 per tree royalty per year. We did ensure in the license agreement, and this is something that, from our standpoint, is unusual to do in any exclusive arrangement, that in our license agreement we provided that Minnesota growers, again this is at the retail level, but the Minnesota growers would have access and guaranteed access to this apple variety. And we did that to address, or we at least hope would address, the concerns of Minnesota apple growers that they would have access to this tree. Final point I'd like to make is that our licensee, and obviously we've spent some time talking to our licensee about these issues, and these issues are well known to our licensee, has expressed a willingness to work with Minnesota apple growers in a way to address their concerns. And again, to the best of my knowledge, Minnesota apple growers, either on the retail level or the wholesale level, have not approached our licensee to talk about their concerns and how they, in fact, might be addressed in the framework of the existing license. And that opportunity is still and remains open for them to do so.
Thank you very much. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, up until today, I think my main contact with apples was eating them, but we're obviously learning quite a bit more about how they're developed and so forth. It does look like there's been kind of a major shift with the university in how you'd handle a product like this. And in fact, some things I'm kind of amazed at. It appears that the trees really are just leased. The trees would be out on the farms, and this Pepin Heights would really have the rights for the branding, the apples, whatever on it. And it looks like you've got some provisions in there where, as you mentioned, if it's a ability to have a retail license, then you can, again, kind of lease the trees, rent the trees, whatever. But if it looks like at the end here, talk about if they don't behave, essentially, the trees will be cut down and they'll have GPS mapping locations with them so they know where they are and all that. Pretty powerful stuff there. I am concerned about a major change in licensing. While I understand that there may be other things done with soybeans and other products, it sounds like this is a real departure from what has been done in the past in the with the apples. And I guess I would urge people to consider this amendment, because I think it's necessary to get out there and have that dialogue you talked about. I think that's very important. I don't know whether we can digest all what has been done and what is being done with this lease agreement and so forth, and we probably don't have the time or necessarily need to get into it that depth, but I do think this study group is warranted.
Thank you. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask if when there is that much of a change in a policy, do you have a format where you invite people to the table to discuss this, to predict that this might happen?
Mr. Strauss, or... Sturgeon?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I did mention that we do have a horticultural variety release committee. That committee is made up of horticultural plant breeders and representatives from industry that talk about how varieties are released. And as I mentioned with apples, this is the first exclusive release with apples. We have been exclusively licensing our other horticultural materials for a long time. So that committee is one way to have input. Also, as I mentioned, that our plant breeder has talked about this particular variety at many of the Minnesota Apple Growers Association meetings and has talked about potential releases of this variety, whether it be public or exclusive. inclusive. So there has been those type of public conversations. One thing that I also do want to mention is that even though this particular variety that we're looking at an exclusive release, this does not mean that any other variety that we release will be an exclusive release. This will be on a variety basis like we have now. We have just released a new variety called Snow Sweet, and the Crop Variety Review Committee has determined that that variety should be publicly released and released publicly. There will still be royalties on that particular tree like there has been with Honeycrisp. And so each of these will be on a case-by-case basis, a variety-by-variety basis, and really looking at what the niche is for that particular variety as we have done in the past.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. So when your committee is going to meet and the agenda is going, this license is going to be placed on the agenda, was there invitations sent to the apple growers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, that committee does have its representation, and so at the discussions within the committee, no.
Representative Ross. When we charge for a license, we charge for fees, the money coming in, can you track that money? Where does that go? Does that go to the general fund or does that go to a department fund?
Mr. Strauss?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
It goes to the football stadium?
No.
Don't tell them. They're going to put caramel on that apple and sell it.
Can I?
It'll be.
I will step outside of my normal role for the university and take a position for the university.
Strike that from the record.
Yes. Okay, that's not where the money goes. The money is brought in and it's distributed under intellectual property policy of the university. And a portion goes back to the investigators, the people that developed the technology, that is in recognition and essentially a reward for their development of this. Other dollars go back to the department that is involved. Those are used for research. In this case, they go back to the plant breeding program and are actually a significant part of the overall dollars that go into the plant breeding program and to continue to develop new varieties. And part of it goes to my boss, the Vice President for Research, which is in part used to support the operations of my office.
One last question, Mr. Chair. What type of dollars are we talking about, say, in this 1914 licensing fee?
Pardon?
What type of dollars are we talking? What amount of dollars are we talking about that could possibly come in from this fees or license cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be highly speculative what we would get out of it, but I can compare that to, and I do not have the numbers off the top of my head, but I believe that Honeycrisp, over its lifetime, has generated something between $500,000 maybe $1 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, witnesses.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that would be safe to assume that this one, if it was similar, would develop four or five times that or more because of the royalties that are required every year. I guess it just seems like a lot of money. Pretty big departure in dollars as well as policy. I have one other question, though. That was just a comment. In this release committee that you talked about, you mentioned that there were representatives from the industry. What does that mean? Does that mean orchard growers? Are they on this release committee as well?
Sturgeon?
You talked about the makeup.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have our current industry representatives are from the nursery industry, both the retail and the wholesale industry.
But are they apple growers?
Or
are they just selling the trees?
Chair, Representative, at this current time, there is not an apple grower or apple industry on that particular committee.
Thank you.
I
just have one quick question. This 1914, does that have a commercial name too? You mentioned the others. Or do we go to the store someday and ask for 1914?
Mr. Chair, again, this variety has just been released and is not yet in commercial production. It will have a name, and the licensee, we're working with the licensee for that name. So many of our varieties all have a number first before they're released, and then they will have a name after that.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl. We need a vote on your amendment.
I'd just like to
thank the committee for their indulgence with this. Once again, I think the amendment is needed because these groups need to be brought together. The apple growers have, I think, been excluded somewhat from this decision process, and it's a, I don't want to see a public institution driving private enterprise out of business.
Representative Berdahl renews his motion for Amendment A1 to be amended in the House File 3975. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. And now we get to House File 3975 as amended.
Thanks.
Any final comments?
Once again, both the College of Veterinary Medicine, the School of Dentistry, have very legitimate claims that I think we need to look closely at and, if at all possible, include them in our budget.
Thank you very much. Representative Berdahl renews his motion then that House File 3975 as amended pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Done deal. We have one more bill.
You put the cameras away now. We're done.
House File 2798. Representative Heidegger. How do you pronounce your name?
So all the New Orleans out there in Pope County say Heidegger.
Heidegger. Thought it was name of that restaurant?
Charlie's Cafe.
Charlie.
Okay. Charlie's Cafe.
We need somebody on the committee to move this.
I'll move the amendment as well.
This is a bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll move the bill. And it's his amendment too.
Yeah.
2798, Representative Heidegger.
Thank you, and thank you. We can move the amendment at the same time.
Oh.
With that discussion, what's going forth here is, I think the press is pretty much portrayed the bill. It's been in just about all of the daily newspapers, editorial in the Pioneer Press yet yesterday, and just about each of the press is caught up with the bill in itself and where it's going and what it's attempting to do.
Representative, maybe we should, we do have the delete all.
Right. I'll move the amendment.
Okay, sorry. Then we'll proceed.
Thank you. And the original bill I had there is modeled after a bill that was passed out in North Dakota last year that was a watered-down bill. It didn't perhaps accomplish talking to the Representative Grandia carried the bill that it was intended to carry, but it did lead to some complaints and a couple of firings. But within the University of Minnesota and within MNSCU, there are policies in place, but complaints are still very prevalent, and very, very few people and very few students are aware of the policies that are in play. I've had St. Cloud State call me if I wanted a bus down today of students. University of Minnesota has also, the students over there have offered that, and Jared Norris and I have been in meeting about this. I want to keep it somewhat low profile and bring the issue forth. And again, I bring this issue forth not as a criticism, but I want to bring it forward so that we're able to address the issue that state colleges and universities' priority is to educate the students who are there. Customers, while research and diversity are important, they should be second and third priorities. I have some testifiers coming today, and basically what I want to do is, the bill is attempting to address the issue, the problem that we have right now with a lot of professors within the college system have a very difficult time speaking English that is understood. And it goes beyond, I know the press has picked up on thick accents and pronunciation, it goes beyond that. It goes to clarity. It goes to being understood. And I have, in order for me to get all of the departments in play, I have an amendment in front of you that I've talked to Representative Tingle said has no problem with this task force. So she said it's all okay. And but any basic task force would be set up, and it would put, and you have in front of you, the important players in play. And what I'm trying to accomplish is, when we get done with this task, but that we have a standard on all of our college campuses where certain professors that are having a difficult time with English would perhaps have to do a speak test that the University of Minnesota has. I'm not asking for a lot. I know there's been some criticism in the press, and a lot of them are not seeing the issue as it is. But anyways, what I'm trying to do is perhaps take off of what the university is already doing. They're requiring all of their international students that are associate professors to take a speak test. And only then, after they pass the speak test, are they allowed to be in the classroom and teaching. There are courses available for speech modification and accent modification that will help some of these professors. But I'm hoping to go a step further. I'm hoping to get beyond the TAs, the teaching assistants, and I want to get that also required of the professors, and also to get these state colleges into play with us. Right now, on some of our state colleges, there are immense problems. The very first weekend I offered a bill, I had a student that just spent the last year in Iraq, was over at St. Cloud State, and had to drop a course. And being that she's in the National Guard, there is some tuition help and everything else. And she had to withdraw from the course because she could not understand her professor. And because of that, she had to pay for the course. The military would not pay for any course dropped. I've had numerous students talk to me about losing their financial aid because of this problem. I've had numerous students tell me that they went an extra year to college to avoid a certain professor. I had numerous students tell me they changed their majors. I've had numerous students tell me they transferred from one college to another in order to obtain their major because they could not get beyond a certain number of professors within certain fields of major. But with that said, I'm going to, at this time, I see where we have a shortage of time. I'm going to call up some of my testifiers at this time. And it's up to you, Chair, if you want to ask all of the questions later on. We can do that after they've all given their testimony.
I think that would be the best.
Okay.
Unless somebody got it. If somebody has one that's urgent, we can make an exception. But you have a list there of your
time? Yes. If, at this time, Jameson Malone is a student at St. Cloud State. And if Pat Malone would come up here at this time, and that we will take a little testimony from them, and they can kind of relate some of the issues that they've had, either as students or parents.
Okay.
And with that, we will start with the youngest, Jameson.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Chairman Nornes and the Committee on Higher Education, my name is Jameson Malone, and I'm a student at St. Cloud State University. I'd like to share my experiences with some of my professors who I believe lack basic English pronunciation skills. During my first 2 years at SCSU, I concentrated on my general education requirements. I attempted to take a required math course during my first semester, but dropped the class after having difficulty understanding my professor. In the next 2 years, I tried taking the same course with different professors and was forced to drop the course again. I had a similar experience with a philosophy course, a film studies course, a computer networking course, and a community studies course. In most of the cases, it proved to be quite difficult to find a replacement course, as most classes are full during the first week of a semester. In a few cases, I simply could not find a replacement course on such short notice, and I decided to take the class. I ended up actually teaching myself philosophy from a textbook. I couldn't take proper notes from the professor's lectures. Asking questions in class or even out of class was pointless, as I had little chance of understanding the response. Basically, if I have to pay for tuition, I believe I deserve professors who are able to effectively communicate their expertise. I don't think it does a lot of good to hire a professor who has to spend a sizable portion of the class repeating himself. I think I deserve better from Minnesota College. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Nornes and Committee on Higher Education, my name is Patricia Plain, and I'm from Plymouth. Today I would like to share the problems that our family has encountered with professors whose English could not be understood. My daughter is presently a senior at Minnesota State University in Mankato. Emily is an education major, and a prerequisite for her degree is a math course. She took this course the fall of her sophomore year. She struggled from the very beginning with understanding her professor. My husband and I advised her to go to the professor and to go to the tutoring lab to get help. She did so and was still unable to understand her professor, but she did receive some help at the tutoring lab. When she tried to switch classes, she was told that all of the other classes for that course were full and she would have to stick it out. She came home over the winter break in tears because she had failed the class, but she had registered for the following spring with a different professor. Any student being taught concepts by a person they cannot understand will ultimately fail. Emily is an honor student whose passion is education. She retook the course and received an A. Our family was forced to pay for the math course twice, and Emily was left with the embarrassment of failing the class. My husband and I have been very pleased with the state universities, as Emily is one of our four children. All but one has attended state universities as undergraduates with impressive results. The one who is not sits in this room today and is a senior in high school. This issue is a major factor in deciding what school he will attend. If proficiency in subject matter is required of our educators, then why isn't the ability to communicate the subject matter required? The ability to transfer knowledge is paramount in our schools. Oral communication is key in education. I myself am a recent graduate from the University of Minnesota in Spanish studies, and am currently a student in the translating and interpreting department. I too can attest to the importance of this bill. A required math course for me was in statistics. My professor was so terribly difficult to understand that I received a D, which significantly lowered my GPA and left me feeling very depressed. So no matter if one is in their early 20s or in their mid-50s, the repercussions of not understanding material can be devastating. We need to ensure that all the undergraduates receive the best education Minnesota can provide by having educators speak clearly in English so they no longer encounter lower GPAs, failed classes, and demoralized students. MSU Mankato has been an outstanding school for our daughter, and she will graduate with her license to teach our very youngest Minnesotans this winter. Her experience has been invaluable, except for that math course problem. Thank you, Chairman Mooney's and Committee on Higher Education, for allowing me time to speak on the behalf of our family.
Thank you very much. Congratulations also.
Yep.
Thank you. And with that, I will call Sharon Cardinal and Glenn Menzi.
Chairman Norris and Higher Education Committee, my name is Sharon Cardinal. I'm from Badness Heights, Minnesota, and I'm also here to speak on behalf of a family member. My son was a student at the University of Minnesota Duluth. I would like to share his story as to what happened with him in terms of a professor he could not understand. My husband and I were very pleased when our son decided to go to UMD, because my husband is also a graduate of the University of Minnesota, so we were excited when he chose that route. He attended the University of Minnesota Duluth for 2 years. As a freshman, he took a 5-credit math class, and he failed it primarily because he could not understand the professor, who spoke very poor English. If the students asked questions during class time, the professor talked even faster then to make up the time that he took to answer the question. And it was even harder for him to understand what he was saying. He repeated the class again as a sophomore. And at this point, he figured he was smarter and more likely going to be able to pass it. He signed up for a different professor. Unfortunately, when he got to class the first day, the university had made a last-minute schedule change, and he got the same professor again. He decided to stick with it. He thought, well, he could get through this. He went to the tutoring center. He went to the professor for help. He went to study sessions. Thought he could get through it. He failed the class again. And we're talking about a 5-credit math class here, so we've got 10 credits gone here. The math class was a class he needed in order to proceed in his major, which was business. He could not go any further with his program of study because he could not get admitted to the major program. He was a sophomore, and as all of you know, by the time you get to be a junior, you need to be taking classes in your major class. As a result of this, he dropped out of school. He was so frustrated, and we were very frustrated because we refused to pay for the class again. We had paid for it twice, and we decided that it was his problem at this point. My son was never informed that he had any rights as a student to get out of a class if he did not understand the professor. Reimbursement was never sought on our part because we were not aware that there was even a possibility that this could happen. If there was such a policy in place at the universities, perhaps it should be better publicized so that students know about it and then they could do something about it. This was a life-altering event for my son, who still has not gone back to school to finish his degree. The university claims that foreign professors are carefully screened to see that they speak the language acceptably and that they, the university, are tuned to this issue. I certainly cannot say that the math teacher that my son had spoke English acceptably. No student should fail a class because he or she cannot understand the professor. My son can totally relate to what many students are going through in dealing with this issue. I think there is a problem with this at the university and its branches, even though they do not seem to want to admit this. I challenge you, challenge them to survey the students and talk to the students and see how many of them are having difficulty with this particular issue. Perhaps it's something that they could do. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome, Glenn.
Chairman Nordis, committee members. I'm here today because I happened to read about Bud's bill. And because my family, myself, and my children have had this problem, I really thought that I'd make the trip down here today to speak with you. And one of the reasons is that for 10 years... Oh, sorry.
Identify your name or for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Glenn Menzie from Starbuck, Minnesota. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's okay. I just happen to know you, but they don't.
So. Exactly. By the way, I do know what a typewriter is, too. It's funny. Yeah. Know.
Without a motor.
Without a motor. Anyway, I actually taught communication for some universities in their business classes for over 10 years. And if you're not able to speak a language, you can't communicate with somebody, obviously learning is going to not take place. My experience with it was I went to University of Minnesota, Morehead State University, I'm sorry, and my experience was in the math department where I encountered it there. And the courses that I took, I withdrew from a course, I retook that course with another professor, and I ran into the same thing again, and eventually took it at a different university where I could find somebody who actually spoke English. But I will tell you that my favorite university professor there was someone from Pakistan who taught me advanced corporate finance. Now, he made the effort to make sure that everyone in the classroom understood him. And if you came to him and said, I don't understand that, he would sit down with you and he would go through and until you did understand it. He made an exceptional effort. He was an absolute fantastic teacher. And I in no way would say that we should not have people from other countries not coming in and being our professors. He really knew his subject, and I really enjoyed that class. My son then decided to go to the University of Minnesota in Morris. He was better at math than me, much, much better, and had hoped he'd be a math teacher or a teacher of some type. And at University of Minnesota Morris, once he got into the calculus level, that's what he began to encounter. And after receiving a C and in a second class, getting into it seemed like he was doing okay, but the last third of the class, at that point, he could no longer learn from others. He wasn't learning from the professor. Learn from others in order to get through that class and ended up with a D in that class. And in fact, when he decided to change his major to ag education, because this really soured him on math, it even hurt him getting into the University of Minnesota down here to get his degree because he'd had these two experiences. He paid for those classes and did work through them. So that brings me to my daughter in the University of Minnesota, Crookston, currently. She has to take a class, and I'm not going to say what course it is because there's only one professor who teaches it up there. And she's been told it was going to be a tough class to begin with. She didn't realize why. And when she started the course, She called home and said, "You can't understand him." And I immediately told her to withdraw from that class. And she did. I had the experience to say, "Get out of that class now." The problem is, she can't get that that class at the University of Minnesota Crookston. Well, the advantage for her is we've been looking at sending her to Tasmania for a year to go to school. After that, because we were looking at options, she would have to go to another university in order to get through this course. If you're on any kind of scholarships where your grade point average and those things are taken into consideration, you need to be able to make sure that you get through these courses. With the higher the cost of the education goes, the more important this becomes. And I think that the universities probably have programs out there. I know Morehead State didn't back in the 70s when I went, because I pursued it. I'm that kind of person. But maybe they do. But it's not out there well publicized. And if there's only one professor on that campus who's teaching that course, you have no other option to go to somewhere else. She'd love to take it there on the campus from that professor. But not only her, but many of the people that take that class simply cannot understand them. Thank you, Chairman Nordis and committee, for your indulgence.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Heidgerken, do you have some other testifiers?
Thank you. Thank you, testifiers, and thank you on my behalf here and behalf of this bill. But no, at this time I told you I'd keep it short, and I wanted to bring the discussion forth, and that is the attempt of the task force. If you look at what you have in front of you there, we do have another handout, and I have had numerous emails. I've got about 100 emails here of students testifying horror stories that happen on campuses, as many as 40% of a class withdrawing. There are issues that need to be addressed, and I think in fairness of time that if someone from Minsky or the University of Minnesota would wish to testify, I would be right at this time.
I know we have some testifiers that are for the bill, put it that way. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Chairman Nornes, committee members. My name is Dennis Nunes, and I am the Dean of Graduate Studies at St. Cloud State University, and I'm also the parent of a son and daughter who attended St. Cloud State University, having had my daughter graduate 2 years ago from St. Cloud State. I understand the concerns voiced here. We take seriously at the university these concerns. We have two groups of Native speakers, those students who come as graduate assistants, and then faculty we hire, particularly in the sciences and mathematics. The graduate assistants, let me assure you, and I won't go into detail for reasons of time, but these individuals are selected carefully, and they're tested in terms of English speaking and listening competencies and writing skills. They present before faculty before they're offered an assistantship to be in a lab or a classroom. They're prepared in that there is orientation, there's extensive speaking in front of faculty and students in terms of their skills are being assessed, and they're supervised while in the classroom by faculty and other peer graduate students on a regular basis. They meet with faculty once a week. We do not put students in classrooms, either native English speakers or non-native English speakers, and simply send them out to provide unguided education of undergraduates. That's not the kind of business we're in. We take very seriously the preparation and the education of the undergraduates who are entrusted to St. Cloud State University. I took great care in advising my son and daughter to attend St. Cloud, and I would not have done so if I didn't believe we were truly committed to an outstanding education of young people. In terms of faculty, every faculty hired is brought to campus. Those are non-English speakers as well as domestic faculty. There's an interview process before the faculty, before a dean in each case. These individuals will make classroom-like presentations in front of faculty, the administration, and often students, depending on the particular department. And they're evaluated on their ability to speak and be understood, as well as on their content. We're obviously not perfect at this. We're certainly willing to work to improve our level of instruction, because that is our business. That's what we're about, and we do take it very seriously. I see the task force amendment. We as an institution, and I believe MNSCU, would be certainly willing to work on these issues to improve the quality of instruction for the students entrusted to these universities. Thank you very much. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then, do you see a need for this task force?
Mr. Chairperson, Representative Udall, I believe the task force could serve a very useful purpose. It's an issue that we're aware of. We work honestly to provide the best instruction. This is not to say that in every class, I can assure you that there is extraordinarily competent faculty with clear English pronunciation. That is our intent. That is our goal. If this task force can increase the quality of instruction, then I'm fully supportive.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this from just a simple business background, I guess, you know, whether you agree with it or not, I kind of consider the students as your customers. They're coming to you for and paying for a service and receiving it. And looking at it that way, it seems with these kinds of things, either one of two things happens. Either the screening process isn't adequate that you're doing, and these people are coming through the cracks and maybe shouldn't be in these classroom situations yet, I'm going to say it. Obviously, I think you must be doing a vetting, proper vetting, so that they have subject content and so forth. But as somebody said, if you can't communicate, you really can't be completely involved in the teaching environment. Or they're morphing into something after you hire, and I have no idea whether that's happening or not. But I guess all I would say to this is, as I think Representative Heidrichen has brought together, brought an issue that probably needs to be addressed. I think it's rather than getting some real prescriptive measures that maybe were out there, I do like the idea of the task force. I think that there's a lot of things to look at. I think hearing the testimony from the earlier testifiers indicates even if it's not a huge percentage, if we have just some percentage of the students that are feeling this way, and especially students that are not able to move forward satisfactorily in their majors, into some of the smaller MNSCU settings where there may be just, as the one testifier said, where there is just a single professor that may be in charge of all the courses in a particular division that you need to get. I hate to say that we force kids to transfer or change majors or do something like this because of a speaking deficiency on here that, like I said earlier, may or may not be there or may or not be perceived at different times, but it probably deserves to be monitored, and I would think the task force like this could do that. And so I think it would make sense to move this along.
Representative Eastland.
Chair, I was just going to ask, has there been any change in the number of professors that are teaching out at the university as opposed to 5 years ago, 10 years, that are not native speaking English?
Mr. Nunes?
Mr. Chairperson, Representative Eastland. Yes, I believe so. The number of faculty, particularly in math and sciences, have increased proportionally. I do not have the numbers, but I'm relatively certain. I've had the opportunity to work at St. Cloud nearly 30 years, and during that period of time, our faculty of color, our foreign faculty, non-native English speakers, have increased. If I might add, perhaps the most constructive thing to come out of something like this, if there were a way in which we can incentivize, if there's such a word, domestic students to enter the math and science areas. Many graduate schools, particularly doctoral institutions, have 80% or more of their students foreign students, and most non-English speaking, at least native English speaking students. To find ways in which we can, from early grades on, bring students into the math and sciences, and then to advanced education, would be a magnificent gain for this certain state and this country. Mm-hmm. I don't have easy answers, but to fill positions in many areas, there are not many choices for universities.
Yeah, I would just going to be something. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just comment. I mean, I went to the University of Minnesota a long time ago, and I was a math major. I had several in the math department. In fact, probably close to half. I think professors that I had back then were actually not Native American speakers, and. One of the most, I remember having one that was very difficult to understand. He actually it was in my, we were on quarters back then, but it was my third quarter of calculus, and it was interesting because it was very, very difficult to understand, but he turned out to be my best teacher.
Yeah.
And it took a little while to learn how to understand him, but I don't know how this issue works, I appreciate some parents, saying that, their students did not do well, and to say that it is all because of the language, I don't know if that's necessarily an accurate statement or not. I mean, I think that's something that we could learn a little bit more about with the task force. So I think this is a good path to go on, because I think clearly when people are investing that much in education, we can take all the obstacles we can away.
Thank you. I was just going to ask one quick question. You mentioned how there is supervision and so forth. If you noticed a lot of students dropping particular classes, does that raise some red flags? Is that one of the things that's also taken into consideration?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, certainly.
The deans monitor, as do the chair of the department, grades in each course, as well as withdrawal rates in each course. Those are indicators of a variety of things, level of difficulty of the course, skill of the instructor in terms of pedagogy, perhaps language, communication. There's a variety of potential issues, and those are monitored for each course and each faculty member.
Faculty also are tenured, right, at some point? I mean, is it difficult to remove a faculty member if they are not up to par?
Faculty member can seek tenure in the process of several years, not to at least 5 years if a person is a probationary until that point. There are also fixed-term faculty who will never be tenured. They're in a year-to-year contract or adjunct. There are a number of categories of faculty. You are correct. After faculty member is tenured, which does allow a relatively extensive period of evaluation and review, it is more difficult to certainly remove a tenured faculty from the university than an untenured probationary faculty member.
Thank you for your testimony. I think there is at least one or two others. Russ Stanton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton. I represent the interfaculty organization, about 3,300 faculty at the state universities, kind of the main target of this bill. We oppose the bill. Let me make it clear, we think every student who pays tuition deserves a faculty member in front of the class that speaks clearly and that they're capable of understanding, but we think that there's far better ways of assuring that than this course. We don't think we need a law to solve every single issue that exists out there, nor do we need a task force to solve every problem that exists out there. We have a board of trustees, we have presidents, we have administrators that assure this. We have processes in place. Every professor is hired face-to-face. They go through a very long probationary period where they're carefully scrutinized, and if there are communication problems, they are going to be caught and dealt with. Now, I know there's complaints. you know, I'll give you an example. I hesitate to use personal examples, but I'm going to. Last semester, my daughter didn't get a very good grade in biology, and when I asked her, she said, well, she had trouble understanding the professor. The only problem is I know the professor. He served on my government relations committee, and I can understand quite well. I think it's a matter of there are two sides oftentimes to a story. We think that these kinds of policies should be developed at ground level where they're being implemented, because they know what's going on, because to develop them at this level can in fact be damaging. I mean, I had lots of emails on this for a lot of reasons. If you look at the bill as originally drafted, it said that any student who said that, who filed a complaint that they couldn't understand their professor, got their money back, their tuition back, and they got their grade expunged, you know, if they're getting a bad grade, a failing grade. Well, it provides a very big incentive for a student that's failing in the class to file a complaint against the professor. You get your money back, you wipe out the record. It said that only 10% of the people in a class could file a complaint and have the professor removed. Well, that would be very damaging to a professor's record. And, you know, in a class of 20, that's two people that would file a complaint. What about the other 90% that might be perfectly happy with that professor's performance? We think that, again, that this needs to be dealt with. We think that the problem is frankly exaggerated. I was recently sent an article in North Dakota when they passed this law. They had four complaints, two from parents, two from students in the state. More and more, we're going to be hiring global professors. It's a global world we're entering. We're going to be hiring people from all over the world. Some of those people are going to come with accents. I think students need to deal with that, because when they graduate and go out into the real world, they're going to run into more and more people in the business world and elsewhere that speak with accents. It's part of their educational process. So we would oppose the bill. We think it's unnecessary. We think there's plenty of processes in place. I will say I travel to every one of our state universities several times a year. I talk to lots and lots of students. I haven't had any student bring this forward until we started discussing this particular bill. So I will be opposed to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Eastland.
Mr. Stanton. You made a lot of comments about the bill as it was introduced, but we're not looking at the bill as it was introduced. What we're looking at here is basically putting together somebody to just look at this issue that involves representatives from Minsky and all the parties, just to see if there is an issue. I mean, is that inappropriate at this point? I mean, I guess
comment to us what's before us. I'd appreciate
yes, we just got the amendment at the start of the meeting here. And I guess having the task force appointed by the governor, I don't think it's necessary, because quite frankly, we have student governments in place. We have internal processes at the colleges and universities in place, and we just don't need another layer up above. We'd rather use the legitimate elected representatives of the various groups to work out a problem, if there is a problem.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stanton, I do appreciate your comments. I think that, however, that if I was running a business and I had 10% of my customers not satisfied with my product, I wouldn't be in business. And I don't know whether it's 10% or not. I have no idea. But I wouldn't be afraid of a 10% threshold if that's happening. I think the Minsky and the university should know about it. And I think what this may do is promote some inquiry. I'm not sure that's the part I'm hearing that we're maybe missing in all this, is that while there may be some processes in place where students could bring things forward, number one, if they're not aware of them, or if they don't feel comfortable doing it, or whatever. It sounds like there's compensating mechanisms that are in place. Either change schools, find another way to get around the professor, you know, drop the course, take it again, hope they don't show up and all that. There's all sorts of enabling and compensating mechanisms in our society today that really aren't all that good to be doing. And I think that I would hope if this moves forward that the task force, it wouldn't have to be a, you know, very lengthy and one, but it might come forward with some information that might surprise you, and I hope that would, and I know if it comes forward and comes back to Minsky, they would deal with it appropriately.
Mr. Chair.
One
question. I believe I moved the bill and then the amendment. My intent was for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So, Mr. Chair, we have till the 11th to continue to work on this. And since Mr. Stanton has just seen the amendment and the other, I assume the University of Minnesota, too, we might get a reaction between now and the 11th on the amended version.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And we have Representative Haas.
Excuse me, am I on your list or not?
Yes, you are. Oh. No, actually, technically you weren't.
I am now, right? thank you very much. I've had two experiences with this in my life. One is a coach where I coached a soccer team that had five different languages other than English. So I was having a little trouble understanding the students. But since it was going to be a win or loss put up on Saturdays, I was very motivated that we figure out a way to communicate. The other is certainly in mathematics, and I do have a math and science degrees, and I was also very motivated, but it causes some hardship in learning. But as one of the other commissioners is saying, that at the end they're some of your best teachers. But I do think that there needs to be a knowledge of the college and of the teachers and of the students that this is going. Not everybody is as aggressive of, you know, I mean, I just kind of pull them by the lips and say it real slow in that ear, because I got to know this stuff. You know, but not every student is going to do that. And some students are going to just run away and not accept it as a challenge. And not all options are offered to them or all knowledge of the college. And I think this task force is a really good idea, so at least we can put the problem above on the surface and discuss it from all the way around the penny. So I think it's a good idea for the task force. I wouldn't be for the original bill.
Thank you for your comment. Mr. Kimball, did you want to testify? Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hal Kimball. I'm a student at St. Cloud State University. I am the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I advocate on behalf of 70,000 students in the state of Minnesota. I would like to take the opportunity to testify on behalf of this legislation today, and I want to just say that I do support Mr. Stanton and our faculty. Our system has amazing faculty that come to us from across the world. These faculty members provide our campuses with a global perspective. They provide this perspective to places like Bemidji, Marshall, in St. Cloud, and in a time in which our governor and other political and business leaders are spanning the globe to make Minnesota more competitive globally, we feel that this perspective is tantamount to the future and the future successes of not only our students, but our state. We all agree that our faculty members should have proficiency in English. However, our students took a position on the original bill this weekend, and our students did not support the original bill this weekend. However, we are concerned about the impact that this does have on the potential candidate pools on our campuses and the potential that impacts the quality of the education on our campuses. And just two stories real briefly. In my capacity as a student leader throughout the state, I was a student body president at St. Cloud State University, and I'm now the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and been involved in student governance for well over 3 years. Prior to Representative Heidgerken's bill being introduced, I had never heard any discussion of this issue prior to the bill being introduced. And in my time as a student at St. Cloud State University, and having taken more than 30 classes at the university, I have had one course in my history in which I had some difficulties in understanding a professor. And maybe I'm a little bit different than some of our students, but I tell hold the adage of personal responsibility. I'm paying for my courses, or at least the Veterans Administration was paying for some of my courses. And I didn't understand. And so what I did was I went to that professor, and I irritated him quite often. And I made sure that he understood that I didn't understand what was going on sometimes. And I met with him in office hours. We had, you know, met with him, bugged him in the student union, and in all sorts of places. And so there is also the adage of personal responsibility as well. So I do want to add that that I think our association is supportive of a task force, but we would like to see some different ways in appointing our students to this task force. So at this time, I guess I will yield for questions.
Well, we thank you for your testimony and Representative Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just your last comment, as Representative Pawlowski noted, there will be some time between today and when we get around to a final bill on this to have some input and consideration on what the task force looks like and how appointments were made. So I hope you'll stay in touch and participate in that discussion.
Thank you, and you do a good job representing those students.
Thanks, sir.
Any other testifiers? Welcome.
Chairman Ornis, members of the committee, my name is Martin Sampson. I'm a faculty liaison from the University of Minnesota. I'm in the political science department. For 5 years, I was director of graduate studies in my department. In those years, we were getting about 160 applications a year, accepting 30 people for a PhD program. We now get about 250. Significant number of the applications were from international students. And in some cases, we found extraordinary people and we admitted them. I recall one situation where I called somebody who was doing an MA at a U.S. university and said to him, "You are our alternate list." And I tried three times and I could not explain to him successfully what I was saying. And as a result, he never got off our alternate list. Every international student we admit is required to go through the University of Minnesota's SPEAK program before teaching a class or before running a discussion section. I am informed by our department administrator that this applies to students who are Canadian, students who are British, students who are from New Zealand, students who are from Australia, and I don't know if that in fact is actually the university policy, but it's our understanding, as I learned, and it's an example of our awareness of the SPEAK program and of taking it seriously. Sure. I know of two cases.
Alabama.
Yeah, that's the problem. I'm getting to that. I know of two cases of students who didn't pass that. In one case, the SPEAK program got the person spoken English up to speed, and the person did pass. In the other case, the student didn't, and we made sure the student did not enter the classroom as an instructor or a discussion section leader. Second point, general point I would simply like to make is that I think at the beginning of this century, we in this country are going through something that looks a bit like what happened in the 50s and the 60s. Deep worries about our technological prowess, whether we were falling behind and the like. We had a visiting faculty member from another country who spoke great English. Now, this is a few years ago. His daughter, who was a third or fourth grader, spoke no English at all and came to us and that year learned to speak English. But the thing about her as a third and fourth grader was that she could already solve algebraic equations with two unknowns. As I understand, for the past 20 years, more than half of the PhDs in engineering in this country have gone to international students, and that currently in the physical sciences, something like 45% of the students in PhD programs are international students. And I think this confronts us with two imperatives. Both are very serious. One of the imperatives is that research universities continue to try to attract the world's best graduate students and best faculty to the United States. It's not a new problem. Einstein came here, John von Neumann came here. The debates about strategic missile policy in this country a few decades ago were between Teller and Hans Bethe, both of whom had worked on the Manhattan Project. We had a Secretary of State who also served simultaneously as National Security Advisor, the only person who's ever done that, namely Henry Kissinger, who also was an immigrant. And I don't know, frankly, whether the English of any of these people would necessarily pass the terms laid out in the original bill. I think in the coming century, there are many fewer Europeans, I would expect, and instead, the task is to recruit the best and the brightest of the people we can find from Asia, and indeed, to compete effectively with Asian universities and research programs. But the point is, it's not a new problem. The second imperative is that we do the absolute best we can do of educating American undergraduate students, of educating them in technical fields, of educating in the humanities, including education about other parts of the world, and including giving them tools for helping them to learn languages, helping them to better understand people elsewhere whose English is not like ours, and for giving them a deeper awareness of histories, cultures, literatures, and the like. And my view is that we have to keep asking ourselves how those two imperatives fit together. We have to keep pushing ourselves to find advantage in the internationalization that's going on that in fact benefits our undergraduate programs rather than handicapping our undergraduate programs. And so, in my view, and this is my concluding observation, where I come out is that this is probably a very good time to look again at what's going on. A former colleague who's no longer at the University of Minnesota came from Arkansas. She would tell you that in early years of teaching at the University of Minnesota, she got complaints that her English was very difficult to understand. She speaks no languages other than English. That's not, I think, the kind of complaint that I heard parents who are in this room talking about before, and I take the comments of those parents very, very seriously. But I think it's important, in a very good moment, to take a look at exactly what is going on, to take a look at a variety of kinds of things that are parts of making sure that instruction is as effective as possible, and that as one component of that, the language of instructors is understandable, or that there is support for people who, let's say they are the 10% of the class, and for some reason they're different from the other 90% of the class, and there's an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't take this lightly. Minnesota Daily a few weeks ago had an article, and as I walked into my 8 o'clock class, it 10 of 8 in the morning and looked around, just I blankly asked the people who were there, how many of you have had an instructor that was difficult to understand? Well, this is a realm of the social sciences, and there were some hands that went up. And I don't know, you know, whether I would have had trouble understanding that English. What I do know is that any student who enrolls in an 8 a.m. class Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and in that group, anybody who has the wherewithal to get there early for class is a serious student. So I think there's potential for the university to improve on the major step forward that it already took. Whether there should be one task force that covers two different systems that have really very different problems and also I think have different opportunities is one of the questions in my mind.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, I think. Anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against? If not, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Heikkerk. And I'm just looking at the amendment and listening to the testimony here. And maybe the one suggestion I would have is on item D. I think there is some autonomy amongst campuses, and there are some differences among campuses. Would you be amenable to an amendment that would basically, this is what I kind of scratched out here. If you would delete line 126, starting with the word create, to the end of the line, and then the beginning of line 27, delete relating to, and insert in place of that, investigate and report on. And so it would read, the task force shall investigate and report on the assessment of all faculty and teaching assistants. And then, based on that information, institutions could create their own policies.
It would be accomplishing the same thing. Create investigate. That's fine because you could do the investigation first. I see what you're going. Yeah, that would be.
Yeah,
fine.
I
would have no problem with that.
The author just incorporate that,
yeah.
Or somebody. Pulaski, would you incorporate
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with the author, that's
yes,
fine.
That's fine. It's accomplishing what.
Okay, we're about out of time.
Yeah, with that, just a couple of closing comments.
Representative Posse, I guess, has
it. Thank you. I have a couple other concerns on the amendment. One, you have picking from the University of Minnesota and from Minnesota State University and from the private college, but the bill relates to public higher educational institutions. Do you want to have a private school student there, or do you want to have public school students there?
Mr. Chair, to that matter, I would like to see the private colleges involved in the discussion if they wanted to participate.
I have no problem. I just had a question, I guess. And then secondly, Mr.
Possible.
Chair, also under 1.21 to 1.22, must serve without compensation or reimbursement for personal expenses that could be
burden on the college students that you're asking to do that, depending on where in the state it's going to be held and how far they have to travel, and do they have to pay for their own mileage and that type of thing. And I think any adults that are doing that, it certainly is all right with me, but I don't think we should be forcing the college students to be paying for that.
Does that matter, Gerben? I know I could have gotten probably 100 students to come down here today and testify on behalf of the bill for nothing. And I think I'll get some students that will want to serve on this committee if others do refuse.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hawks.
Commissioner, and that's probably true that you can find some that mm-hmm. can do that, but you also may eliminate some that cannot do it. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm more concerned about those that are being eliminated rather than those that are being selected.
Question of the author, how often do you expect this task force to meet? How many times?
And Mr. Chair, to that, and I basically took Representative Seifer to work some at a college, and he drew this up for me. He thought, you know, having working with, he's a recruiter and everything else, he works very closely with the college faculty, he thought this would be the best policy to go forth with, so I'm taking his expertise advice.
But my question is how many
more? How many times? I would say if we had the first meeting, I think we could get where we want to get. I really do. I don't think it would take very long.
Going just, back to Representative Hawks' concern.
Are you talking about one meeting or two meetings?
I'm talking about one meeting I think would do it.
I withdraw.
Okay. All right.
And
go ahead.
Okay, with that, again, I changed, and I did have a bill forth that the Texas, Connecticut already have passed. Other states have done that. And it's a bill that resonates not only in the state of Minnesota. I mean, I've never received, when I go home, and I was at a meeting last week at the Corn Growers, and somebody brought the bill up, and 100 people stood up and applauded. And it's an issue that resonates, and it is an issue with the parents out there and with the students. It's something that we can't easily dismiss. But I didn't think it was going to be that big of an issue. And when I did, you know, the number of TV stations and the radio stations in the area, and then when I did Fox National, did a call-in show, I did a Good Morning America call-in show national. It does resonate. I know there's some issues with Representative Latz. I did a call-in show in West Virginia, and I do know what you're speaking when it comes to dialects and everything else, and pronunciation. But anyways,
I believe WCCO has been here today too.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, thank you. But anyways, what I'm just trying to do is I'm not requiring, and you're on K-12, Representative Latz, I'm not requiring a college professor to go through the rigors that a first grade teacher has to go through. I'm not requiring them to take a bunch of methods courses. I'm not requiring them to go out a half year student teaching. I'm not requiring any of that. Basically, what I'm trying to do is just address the issue where we get the issue. There's a lot of good foreign professors. There's a lot of good professors that do come from foreign countries, but I'm just trying to get something that the University of Minnesota has started, and that is a speak test. And I think if we carry that across, I think that would be our answer. What do you do? And I love the testimony from the University of Minnesota today. With that said,
all right, thank you. Representative Pulaski, would you renew the motion?
Absolutely, as amended.
Okay. As amended, that House File 2798 pass and be laid open for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, members.
Okay, thank you. And with that, our meeting, before I adjourn the meeting, we should hopefully have at least our target. Probably has already been set. We'll find out officially what that is. Okay, it hasn't changed. No, it's 4.8. Representative Blossom.
Do you anticipate splitting that between the U and Minsky, or? No, I'm just kidding.
So we hope to have our bill put together so that you'll be able to see it and then make amendments to it by Monday when we'll finalize the bill. That sound okay? With that, our meeting is adjourned.